empowered time, you know, in that era.
First of all, we have to know and we have to understand the circumstances and the environment in which our imam used to live. And then we can have, inshallah, beautiful connection with that certain imam. As we know that our 9th imam, 10th imam and 11th imam, all these three imams, they were in the time of Abbasi Khalif. And Abbasi Khalif, their center of ruling was in Samarra.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the condition, like, you know, I can say, like, Sister Ramli, whenever I say Imam Hassanul Askari, the name Askari itself is giving so much message to us.
What is the message?
Yeah, because, you know, even we love to cry for his, you know, that great operations and, you know, that all cruelty which occurs to him. Because Askari means the place, in which area the rulers of that time, they forced to leave him there. You know, he was there. And not even our 11th imam, even our 10th and 11th, all of them, they were in the city of Samarra because, you know, the present rulers, they wanted to observe and see and, you know, wanted to put them in very, very restriction condition,
have
very near to them. Yeah.
Mm.
So that's why they live in the same country and means city. And the area name was Askar. Askar means, you know, as we know in Arabic, like Lashkar means the army city, you know. So in that very restricted condition, our imam used to live.
Mm.
I love to mention that, but our 11th imam, his condition was more difficult compared to the 10th or 9th imam. By passing the time, people used to get to know about the reality of these rulers are not on and they're right.
Not just
here. Because they came with the name of Islam and with the name of even Alawi, they used to say, we are the followers of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and from their generation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But slowly, when time passes, they get to know that everything is not, you know, like how they used to put it. So that's why when the truth becomes clear and obvious in the eyes of the people, the rulers, they make definitely, you know, so much restriction because they know they want to come towards the true successor of the prophet and
right.
the true, you know, like you can say, caliph. So that's why they put a lot of condition. And second reason is because even they knew it, the rulers of that time, they knew it that the last successor of the prophet will be the son of the 11th imam, Hassanul Askari.
Right.
And, you know, directly imam never ever had, you know, so like chance to meet his companions at all.
Right.
So that much restriction, just because, you know, they knows that one person will come from the generation of 11th imam, who will, you know, perish the all evils from the world. So that's why there was a lot of restriction in our 11th imam's time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. An imam or leader's job in a society is to guide people.
Yes.
Right? At that time, the imam himself was present. But because of all the restrictions, was he able to communicate with the people, with the Shiite community at that time? I mean, how did he transfer his knowledge? How did he answer the questions of the public? You know, how was that done? Having in mind the fact that, as you said, he was under very hard restrictions and under, you know, a close eye of the Abbasid caliphs. How was this made possible?
Yeah, well, we can get to know easily from history that even our Imam Hassan al-Askari, he himself, he said that, you know, my followers are facing more doubts and problems about imamah, about the issue of imamah, compared to my father's Shias and followers, because none of them had that much complicated, you know, circumstances which I have it.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely he knows that how much, you know, problems they are facing it. So history says that our 11th imam, he used to connect with his nation and his people by his, you know, the way he used to strive in the way of sciences and knowledge and ilm. You know, he used to give, like as Sheikh Etusi, he said that 11th Imam, he had more than 100 very precious students, you know,
wow.
full of knowledge and wisdom. And then sometimes, you know, he had a beautiful network system of, you know, spreading and giving message towards all the, you know, cities where his believers and Shias used to live. Like how history says that in the city of Kufa, Baghdad, mm-hmm. Nishapur, Qom, Khurasan, Yemen, Ri, Azerbaijan, Samira, Basra, in these cities, the Shias were used to live there. They were the most of the Shias.
Right.
And he has the beautiful chain of his, you know, agents and representative and deputies in his time.
Oh, and so he had deputies. Was he directly in contact with the students? Or
yes.
did he have deputies who transferred his messages or his teachings to the people? Was he directly in contact with the people of the community?
Yeah, most of them, they were directly contact with him, like, and some of them, they were not. That's
mm-hmm.
why he used to, you know, write for them letters.
Mm-hmm.
So we have so many letters. History has, you know, saved that letters for us. If we read it out, it's so beautiful. It gives a lot of, you know, message and light and nur for us. So inshallah, we will talk later on.
What I got from you is that he was in direct contact with the people, right? And he also had some deputies that transferred his knowledge and transferred, you know, answered the people's questions through the deputies.
Yeah, most
is that
of
right?
the time, yeah. Like very special one,
mm-hmm.
They were near to him. Like, you know, like about Uthman bin Sa'id Amri.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have so many stories
mm-hmm.
in history that it shows that there wasn't any chance to meet directly just because of question and answer to Imam.
Oh.
Like, Uthman bin Sa'id Amri, he was the olive seller, in the form of the olive seller. And what he used to do, it's so beautiful. And again, you know, it makes our heart so sad that, you know, this kind of Allah's true, you know, like representative in this earth,
mm-hmm.
this light, they were here,
yeah.
but, you know, they were not allowed to have a direct contact with the servants of Allah. But how, you know, they used to do it. Like they said, because Uthman bin Sa'id Amri, he was the olive seller. He said that usually the letters, even the money, you know, the financial support, which our Imam used to do to his, you know, companions, because
uh-huh.
we know that if any nation, if they don't have good support financially,
mm-hmm.
then automatically they will go towards other, you
You're
know,
right.
religion.
That's so smart.
And, yeah. So because they know that Imam knows that I have to support them. And even because he had so many deputies all over the world, and they used to bring the homes and that, you know,
mm-hmm.
special amount of money to him. Like,
yeah.
we have so many evidence in history. Like, it says that even just from Qom, like
mm-hmm.
Ahmad bin Ishaq, he was one of the deputies of our Imam.
Mm-hmm.
He brought 160 golden coins to Imam. And, you know, 700 dinar from Ahalul Jabal. They said so many cities, they are
mm-hmm.
giving the name of cities and countries that from where people used to give. But how? Like, they used to put him inside the bottle of the oils.
Mm.
Sometimes other, it's so beautiful that Dawood bin Aswad, when other, you know, deputies of Imam, he was the wood collector.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, he used to bring wood to Imam's house, you know.
Okay.
They used to come in this form because
right.
they were not allowed
not to be recognized.
Yeah. So once Imam gives some wood to Dawood and said, give it to Uthman bin
mm-hmm.
Sa'id Amri, because he was the one of representative of our last Imam in minor
occultation.
Yeah. Uthman bin Sa'id Amri,
mm-hmm.
he was in the time of our 11th Imam
mm-hmm.
and he was the first representative of our 12th Imam.
Wow.
Yeah. So he said, like Dawood bin Aswad is saying, Imam Hassan Askari, he gave wood to me and he said, take this wood and give it to Uthman bin Sa'id.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that there was some letters inside the
wood. The
wood,
hidden in the woods.
Yeah, hidden
wow.
in the woods. So it's so amazing, like, you know, how these techniques and styles and, you know, this everything was there and how much restriction was,
You're
you know,
right.
in my Imam's time.
Do you know the exact number of the deputies? Were they many or just few?
So many we have, but exact numbers we can't give it because there were so many, like we have companions
mm-hmm.
and some of them were, you know, like by letters Imam said, this is my representative and deputy. You can give money to them, and mm-hmm. you can ask the laws and fiqh question to the, from them. So that's why we have different kind of deputies. They just used to give the message from imam, mm-hmm. like they have a question, you know, right. istighfar we yeah. call it. So there were different kind of deputies and representative of our right. imam he had.
Dr. Najafi, thank you very much for your very informative answers. We learned a lot from you today. This was the end of the first part of our program. I'd like to bless this part with a beautiful hadith from Imam Hassan al-Askari. He said, generosity has a limit. When crossed, becomes extravagance. Caution has a limit. When crossed, becomes cowardice. Thriftiness has a limit. When crossed, becomes miserliness. Courage has a limit. When crossed, becomes foolhardiness. Let this moral lesson suffice. Refrain from doing anything which you would disapprove of it done by someone else. Now I invite you to listen what our colleagues have prepared for you in this part of the program. Okay? We'll be right back. Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari, the son of the 10th Imam, was born in 232 or 845. And according to Shi'ite sources, was poisoned and killed in 260 or 872 through the instigation of the Abbasid Caliph Al-Mu'tamid. The 11th Imam gained the imamate after the death of his noble father, through divine command and through the decree of the previous Imams. During the 7 years of his imamate, due to untold restrictions placed upon him by the Caliphate, he lived in hiding in Taqiyya. He did not have any social contact with even the common people among the Shiite population. Only the elite of the Shia were able to see him. Even so, he spent most of his time in prison. There was extreme repression at that time because the Shiite population had reached a considerable level in both numbers and power. Everyone knew that the Shia believed in the imamate, and the identity of the Shiite imam was also known. Therefore, the caliphate kept the imams under its close supervision more than ever before. It tried through every possible means and through secret plans to remove and destroy them. Also, the caliphate had come to know that the elite among the Shia believed that the 11th imam, according to traditions cited by him as well as his forefathers, would have a son who was the promised Mahdi. The coming of the Mahdi had been foretold in authenticated hadith of the Prophet in both Sunni and Shiite sources. For this reason, the 11th Imam, more than other Imams, was kept under close watch by the Caliphate. The Caliph of the time had decided definitely to put an end to the imamate in Shiism through every possible means and to close the door to the imamate once and for all. Therefore, Al-Mu'tamid sent a physician and a few of his trusted agents and judges to the house of the imam to be with him and observe his condition and the situation within his house at all times. After the death of the imam, they had the house investigated and all his female slaves examined by the midwife. For 2 years, the secret agents of the caliph searched for the successor of the imam until they lost all hope. The 11th imam was buried in his house in Samira, next to his noble father. Welcome back to the program Sunset in the Heaven. We are at the presence of Dr. Razia Batul Najafi here with us. In the first part of the program, she told us about the conditions and circumstances at the time of Imam Hassan al-Askari. Then she talked about the students, specific deputies and representatives of Imam Hassan al-Askari. In this part, I'm going to ask her another question. That question is, taking into account the very severe and harsh circumstances at that time. As you mentioned before, the conditions that were present at the time of the 9th Imam, the 10th Imam, and 11th Imam, the fact that they were all under very close restrictions of the Abbasid Caliphs. Now we come to the 12th Imam. And the Abbasid Caliphs, they all knew that this hadith from the Holy Prophet, where there are 12 Shiite Imams, 12 Imams for the community, they will come one after the other. Now the 11th Imam is there, and they know of his presence. They know that he is the just 11th Imam. Now it comes to the 12th Imam, which is his son. Now, it's a very scary and tough circumstances. How does the 11th Imam prepare for the coming or the arrival of his son, Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam? Could you please tell us a little more about this?
Not only our 11th Imam, he was preparing for this, major occultation of, or minor occultation of our last Imam. Even our 10th Imam, Imam Hadi alayhi salam, he was, in his time even, he was started to prepare his companion. So the best way to prepare the followers, first of all, to inform them, know, to tell them, and even they knew it, because it wasn't a new issue. Because our prophet, he used to inform, and he used to give a lot of information and hadith in his time. But the beautiful way which Imam is preparing his companion in his time, it was how to contact with Imam if Imam is not present physically.
Right.
Like, even we can say our 11th Imam, even he wasn't physically
present,
like present, right, in that sense that he wasn't allowed to meet directly. So in his time, he started to write a lot of letters, and he started to make that again beautiful network of a representative, and people used to ask from Imam. These are the two ways to get connected and to take that benefit from Imam. We have one narration that it shows that Ahmad bin Ishaq, as I have mentioned, that he's one of the great student of our 11th Imam. When he asked about the successor of Imam Hasan al-Askari, he asked who will be the Imam after you. Then Imam called him in his house, and then he went in other room, and he brought one durable and beautiful son, a 3 years old boy, and he said that he will be my successor after my death. And then Imam said, oh Ahmad bin Ishaq, if you are not be respectful in my and Allah's eyes, I never ever would like to show this treasure in front of his name is the same name of our prophet. His title and kunya is the same kunya of prophet, and he will be have the long occultation like Prophet Khizr and Dhulqarnain. And this occultation will be occur in the very, very long period. Then many of our followers, they will put in doubt, except few of them. And those few of them will, Allah will give them this opportunity that they will do a lot of prayers, and they will, act the way that this occultation will
finish, inshallah.
Yeah, it will finish sooner, inshallah.
Inshallah. Dr. Najafi, we are in the time of the major occultation, okay? How can we, claiming to be the Shiites of Imam Ali, what can we do? How can we act so that his occultation would be shortened and we would see him soon, inshallah?
Yeah, it's a very practical and beautiful question. The answer we can find very easily from one of the letters of Imam Hasan Askari, because he has written one letter to Ibn Babawi, one of his representative in the city of Qom.
Really?
Yeah. And look at the way, how he is addressing this great, like we can say, scholar of his time. Ibn Babawi is the one of the, scholar, but Imam is saying, Ya Shaykhi wa Mu'tamadi wa Faqihi Ya Abul Hassan Ali ibn Hussein al-Qumi. So beautiful, the way he's putting himself as a very nearer to his, companion. And he's saying, Oh my, Sheikh or the person in whom I trust, Mu'tamidi.
Right.
And my faqih, you are my scholar, you are my alim, you know, you are from me. So then he's giving so many beautiful advices until he reaches to about, he's saying, like, we have so many other narrations and hadith which says that A'inuni bilwara wa ijtihadi wa sidadi wa ifa, like Imam is calling us and Imam is seeking help from us. Mm-hmm. And Imam is saying, please help me by your piety, mm-hmm. by your, you know, good deeds, by your struggle and, you know, the hardshipness towards good deeds. So here Imam is saying, man istakhafa bis salati al-layl falaysa minna. If you want to become a true awaiter, and if you want to pass this awaiting time in active way, not in passive way, mm-hmm. so you, it's good, it's recommended to give importance to the night prayers, you know, like Salatul Layl, which is not, you know, obligatory, which is not a wajib.
It's just recommended.
Yeah, but he's saying man istakhaffa, who is very careless.
Thinks lightly.
Yeah, very light and, you know, takes very, very careless and takes lightly, who takes very lightly this night prayer, mm-hmm. he would not be among us, you know, true companions and true followers. And then Imam is saying, I will give you the very blessful son, uh-huh. you know, and we know his son was Sheikh al-Saduq, and uh-huh. he has written one book, Man La Yahdhuruhu al-Faqih, which is one of the major, you know, sources of book which we have, right. Kutub-e Arba'a, one of the Kutub-e Arba'a.
Yeah. Very valuable.
Very, very valuable, and one of the great, you know, treasure which we have in this era. Mm-hmm. And then Imam is saying, Ibn Babawayh, oh my Sheikh, be patient and wait for true happiness. Faraj means the happy. Like, that's why we say, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum. Ajil farajahum literally means, oh Allah, hasten their. There means, hum means Ali Muhammad, Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. There's happiness, you know, like means reappearance of our last Imam. So then Imam is saying, if you fulfill your requirements and your duties and your responsibilities during this era, during the waiting time, so then you are doing the best worship and ibadah. Why? Because I have heard, Imam is saying that I have heard from Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that he said, "Afdalul amal intizarul faraj." It is the best deed. Like, why? Because if I'm a true awaiter, then definitely I will cover. Right. I will, you know, give beautiful response to all laws of Allah.
Exactly.
You know, even in the roots of the religion and the branches of the religion. And I love to mention this saying of our 11th Imam. Even he said, "Inna al-wusul ila Allah azza wa jalla safarun la yudraku illa bi imta'il layl." I love it. It's so beautiful.
What is the meaning?
The way he's watching, you know, the way he's looking to the prayer, night prayer. Mm-hmm. Our 11th Imam is saying, nearness to Allah is the journey. Uh-huh. It's a spiritual journey. This spiritual journey needs somehow some vehicle. Uh-huh. We have to sit on it and go. And the beautiful tool and the beautiful way to go towards that qurb and that nearness and closeness to Allah is night prayer. Uh-huh. You know, Salatul Layl.
Wow.
It's so beautiful. Yeah.
Dr. Najafi, we learned a lot today about Imam Hassan al-Askari and about the occultations. Now, we would like you to tell us a little more about his age, when he was martyred, and how he was martyred, and where he is buried. Could you please tell us a little more about these?
As history tells us that our Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari, when he got martyred, he was only 28 years old.
So young.
Very young. Like, wow. Again, you know, we feel so much, you know, grief and sorrow for our young Imam.
Mm-hmm.
And not only him, this as we have mentioned before, that these three Imam, they mm-hmm. were in the city of Samarra. All of three, they were in very young age. Imam
How
Jawad,
old were they?
Yeah, Imam Jawad, as he known as the youngest Imam, yeah,
uh-huh.
who has died in the very, very young age.
How old?
He was only 25 years old,
wow.
when he got martyred.
So sad.
Yeah, very sad. And Imam Hadi alayhi salam, he was 41 years old.
Uh-huh.
So altogether, they were there was only 92 years they could, you
of
know,
Imamet.
Live in this world. And we know that Mu'tamid, one of the Abbasid caliph, he has given the poison to our 11th Imam,
mm-hmm.
as our Prophet, he has said that all of us, me and my all successor, they will get martyred or by murder or killing or by poison. So we know that he has buried in the city of Samarra in his own house next to his father Imam Hadi alayhi salam. And still, even in this time, in this era, we can feel very, very obviously that how
oppression.
Oppression is going on in this that city. Still, that is Askar. You know, there's full of Askar and full of armies are there and soldiers are there. And still now it wasn't allowed to go there. You know, nowadays, thanks God that people can go and visit their holy shrines. Mm-hmm. And I will pray to my Allah that if we get true ma'rifat and recognition about this holy personalities, really we love to go and visit them. Because, you know, this is the promise of our Prophet. He said that if you visit us in this world with definitely ma'rifah. Ma'rifah and recognition and with real visiting, then we all, me and my all successor, Mashallah. We all will visit you in the day of judgment.
Mashallah.
So we need that beautiful, you know, personalities and that light of Allah to them, inshallah. So may Allah give us this beautiful opportunity to do their ziyarat and true visit,
inshallah. Okay, I'd like to end this part of the program with another beautiful hadith or saying from the 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari. He said, "Let piety be your provision, patience be your garment, and buy hardship in the path of Allah. Be true in your speech, trustworthy in performing your deeds. Prolong your sajda, means prostration. Deal with others with best behavior and treat your neighbor amicably. Perform your prayers even with those whom you think to be your opposition. Attend their funeral ceremonies, visit their sick, and give them their right. Verily, I tell you that whosoever is honest and has good behavior in the eyes of others, he is the pious Shia whom I will be proud of. Therefore, fear Allah, be as adornment on behalf of us, and be not as shame that defames our name. This is the only way by which others shall be attracted toward us, the Ahlul Bayt of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam." Once more, we'd like to express our wholehearted condolences on the sad event or the martyrdom of our 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari. Thank you for being with us up to here. Dr. Batul Najafi, thank you very much for being here in the studio today and answering our questions.
It was a great opportunity for me. Thank you so much for having me here.
It was an honor to have you here. We learned a lot from you. Thank you again, and we wish you a very good time and goodbye.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Opening a defense exhibition in Pyongyang, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un maintained the arms on display provide deterrence, and that it's the United States and South Korea which engage in destabilizing and threatening behavior. Their hypocritical attitude and the U.S. tacit sponsorship continue to damage inter-Korean relations, and their unlimited dangerous attempts to strengthen military capability are disrupting the balance of power in the region, aggravating military instability. North Korea has recently restarted ballistic missile testing, while South Korea has undertaken a massive arms buildup of advanced new planes, ships, submarines, and missiles, with U.S. assistance. Activists suggest dialogue is needed to cool tensions.
When negotiations with North Korea were held, North Korea at least stopped nuclear tests and missile development. A dialogue channel should be opened as soon as possible. To do this, the U.S. should present at least some specific proposals.
The U.S. says there needs to be strong enforcement of existing sanctions on North Korea, although it will meet, quote, unconditionally. Some argue sanctions on Pyongyang need to be reviewed at least. South Korean officials have been more assertive in calling for a new approach from the U.S. According to North Korean state media, leader Kim Jong-un also said North Korea's military might does not target South Korea, and that there should not be another war pitting the Korean people against each other. The 1950-53 Korean War ended in an armistice, not a peace treaty. And South Korean President Moon Jae-in seeks an end-of-war declaration before he leaves office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In October 2018, a liter of fuel in diesel-dominated France hit €1.53. And for the next 7 months, every Saturday in Paris was a war zone of state repression. The price of diesel gas has just surpassed that all-time record, and many wonder if a return of the yellow vests is now around the corner. After the unprecedented corona lockdowns, diesel, petrol, natural gas, electricity, and prices in general continue to soar worldwide. Inflation in France has just accelerated to the highest rate in 10 years. Western leaders continue to insist the inflation is temporary, but many in France say the economic tension is undeniable.
I would very much like Macron to recognize that the French cannot live with this type of inflation. I normally budget €60 to fill up my car, but today I paid €80. All these price increases in so many areas are a real catastrophe for the French.
Gasoline taxes are regressive taxes because they place the same costs on rich and poor alike. 60% of France's gasoline costs are due to taxation. Many drivers wonder if the right-wing government of Emmanuel Macron is prepared to ease this winter's burden on the average household by making the wealthy and big business pay a fair share. As cold weather nears, a 250% increase in natural gas is forcing European governments to take last-minute action, including caps to corporate profits in left-leaning Spain. France's government is set to announce a small one-time payment for only the poorest households to combat energy costs, which show no sign of easing. France uses the third most natural gas in Europe. The persistent price rises and entrenched unemployment may upend Western plans to finally end quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies, which have produced record economic inequality. Those policies and the disastrous corona recession may have already set the stage for the next economic era across the West, dreaded stagflation. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Around 90% of Portugal's population is now vaccinated. In Bulgaria, the figure is just 22%. Both are members of the EU, but in countries like Bulgaria and Romania, people do not trust what they're being told about the vaccines. Senior European Commission officials attended a meeting of EU health ministers on Tuesday.
My main messages today continue: vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. The difficulties that some member states are currently facing with COVID-19 cases at record high and extreme pressure on hospitals is a stark reminder of this.
Critics say EU health authorities are putting the bloc's vaccination strategy in peril by not giving a clear message on the benefit of booster vaccines. For example, here is what the European Medicines Agency has been saying.
So it's not a strong recommendation as sometimes we do when we really see the need of a booster in the overall population.
The Eurozone economy is already at breaking point due to the pandemic. A conference in Brussels has been discussing the growing problem of long-term unemployment.
It's like a car. If you let a car that is not used for many time in your garage, in your storage, it doesn't work like before. But it doesn't mean that it cannot be recovered at the full of their potential. But this is the responsibility of the government on that.
Gas and electricity prices are soaring in the 19-nation Eurozone, adding to economic uncertainty. But gas and electricity costs aren't the only concerns.
Oil, but also other commodities, and certain commodities like metal need a lot of energy to be produced, so there's a direct link.
And there is a direct link between health and the economy. At their meeting, EU ministers pledged to donate 500 million COVID-19 vaccines to less well-off countries before the middle of next year. Aid agencies insist the EU has a moral duty to keep this promise. Health authorities and economists say the move is in the bloc's own interest in the context of trying to prevent the virus from mutating. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
With Lebanon plunging into darkness as two main power stations barely function, Hezbollah Secretary General called on the government to bring on a complete solution to electricity blackouts.
We need to have a drastic solution to the electricity issue, build new power plants, solve the problems in the current power plants. There are several proposals on the table from various countries in the East and the West. If you don't want from the East, then take proposals of the Western countries. Unless there is an American veto and the Americans are prohibiting you. Tell that to the Lebanese people honestly.
Nasrallah uncovered that the Lebanese government has even turned down offers from countries like Germany and France for fear of U.S. sanctions. He urged the Lebanese government to seek a waiver.
There is a new proposal given by Iran's foreign minister in Beirut a couple of days ago. He said Iran is ready to build two power plants and provide a very good amount of fuel. Give him an answer. Seek a sanctions waiver. For us, the U.S. is an enemy. We can expect anything from an enemy, but if you consider it a friend and a confidant, then fine. Ask this beloved friend, whom you believe has humanity, to make an exception like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Small businesses have been struggling and say they are experiencing what they call a slow death to make ends meet. What this man used to do using electricity, he's now doing with his own hands.
We used to see the electricity for 30 minutes or so, but now nothing. This area used to be a busy area. Now all the work and shops have shut down. Electricity is everything in my work. Now I'm working manually using a saw. I even stopped a private generator because I can't afford it.
Those who can afford it are turning to private generators. Rabia is the owner of one of the private generators south of Beirut. Before the import of Iranian fuel, the bill cost a fortune.
We suffered so much before, especially when we had to raise prices. It's always the people who have to pay the heavy price because of the black market. We thank God and we thank Syed Hassan and the Islamic Republic who launched this initiative and saved us from the dark, and saved the people from paying a very high bill.
Alamana Petroleum is selling the Iranian diesel for almost half the official price, with the subsidies lifted. While the leader of the resistance did declare that Hezbollah will be donating and selling Iranian fuel for the second month, he also stressed that this is only a temporary solution.
On top of the socio-economic crisis in Lebanon lies an almost total collapse of the electricity crisis. Hezbollah Secretary General has called on the government to prioritize the issue in order to put the country on the track of a drastic solution. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's major nuclear facilities have been targeted by cruise missiles. Iranian air defense says it has successfully foiled the attack using homegrown missile systems. This is the scenario for a massive military drill held over a 500,000 square kilometer area in central Iran, codenamed Defenders of Velayat Skies. The air defense exercise engaged the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division.
In these dreams, we have simulated real-life war scenarios, where the enemy uses manned and unmanned aircraft, as well as cruise missiles, to attack our sensitive facilities. And air defense units will use indigenously built defense systems to counter the hostile force.
These military exercises are held as part of our annual routine drills. They are not a threat to any country and are aimed at boosting our deterrence and increasing our preparedness against any potential hostile move.
The air drill involved the latest military equipment developed by Iranian experts, including missile systems, drones, and radars. Iranian military officials boast the country's capabilities in indigenizing the defense industry and say they owe this to the long-running U.S. arms embargoes.
We have gone through decades of sanctions imposed against our defense sector. But we prove that if we discover our domestic capacities, we will definitely be able to build up our defense arsenal and protect our sovereignty using our know-how. I should say that in this maneuver, all of the equipment are made inside Iran.
The annual maneuver started on Tuesday and will continue until Wednesday.
Military officials here say, given the recent developments in Iran's eastern and northwestern borders, there's a need to boost coordination and synergy between the Iranian army and the IRGC to counter any potential threats. They say these drills can help achieve such a goal. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
After taking power, the Taliban leaders reached to the Shia community seeking their support and allegiance. The Taliban officials said their government will include all Afghans and social justice will be protected.
Today's Shia people are safer than before. We don't let any individual hurt you. You are from Afghanistan and have equal rights. The Islamic Emirate recognizes you as part of Afghan society.
The Shia Ulama Council at a press conference on August 24 urged the Taliban to ensure that they will treat all faiths and ethnicities with equality and justice.
We are happy that U.S. forces have left our country. Congratulations to the Afghan nation. In the meantime, we demand and recommend that the Taliban fulfill their promises by forming an all-inclusive government.
During weeks under the Taliban rule, many people from the Shia community have reportedly been displaced in Dikandi and some were massacred by the Taliban in Ghazni and Dikandi, Amnesty International confirms. At the same time, the Daesh still takes lives from the community. Nearly 300 Shia worshippers were killed and wounded in Kunduz blast on Friday. Following this tragic event, Shia Clerics Council in Afghanistan once again urged the Taliban to investigate the deadly attack and take massacre of Shia seriously, as well as call for unity among all Muslims.
Shias are making 20% of the population of Afghanistan. The Taliban can't establish an inclusive Islamic government without giving equal role to us. We also condemn the catastrophic attack in Kunduz and urge the Taliban to bring its perpetrators to justice.
After taking power, the Taliban promised the formation of an inclusive government and providing a safe ground for all Afghans. But Shia minority is concerned that the threat of Daesh terrorist group is being ignored by the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš is the most high-profile politician in the EU to be exposed by the Pandora Papers leak earlier this month. It was revealed that Babiš, who lost a re-election bid just last Saturday, spent 19 million euro using tax haven companies to buy a chateau in France. The scandal has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Andrej Babiš behaves again as a hypocrite, as a liar, as a person despising democracy, but this time also as a businessman doing shady transactions.
Hundreds of current and former politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers have used so-called shell companies to hide their wealth and investments.
Madam President, I am livid.
A consortium of journalists from around the world compiled a report containing 12 million leaked documents, dubbed the Pandora Papers.
As countries scramble for millions to fund health and social services, $11 trillion are out of reach offshore.
Most of those avoiding tax are based in the West. EU leaders who talk a lot about values are accused of hypocrisy.
Why is the United States, which is not cooperative, again not mentioned, whereas in the Pandora Papers it's very clear that the United States are becoming a bigger and bigger problem?
Experts warn the issue will never be resolved unless the rich and powerful develop a conscience.
I think that the ultimate question in the end is individual ethics, and living by good example, you know, by those, you know, who actually want to defend the system. And without that, the best monitoring, the best legal framework, the best regulation can't save you.
Legislators say a big problem relates to the amount of money politicians and policymakers can generate for themselves.
Where action could but isn't taken, there's obviously no political will to stop mass tax evasion by the super rich.
Revelations like these are nothing new. Lawmakers say it proves European Commission policies in this area are not working, and therefore it is simply a matter of time before more scandals come to light. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Karim Abu Salim threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector that is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Karim Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Karim Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also express the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that caused serious financial losses. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, this is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world, and I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are not seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that
We all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, "Keep it in the ground." Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue. That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially. World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with many selling the new banners amid heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes and houses. I make good money and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women are seen to be staying off the streets, but some are seen in longer coats and headscarves and some in the all-covering burqa. Fewer men are seen wearing Western dress as they have switched to local clothes. The Taliban takeover changed the face of capital Kabul in many ways. The nation's already flagging economy is collapsing and creeping chaos is in the making. It remains to be seen what future holds for the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Climate change is the single biggest health threat facing humanity, the UN agency says. While no one is safe from the health impacts of climate change, they are disproportionately felt by the most vulnerable and disadvantaged. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Burning of Fossil Fuels is Killing Us." WHO warns in COP26 report. Stay tuned for more. Looking toward the United Nations summit scheduled for the end of the month, a top UN agency recently released a report that makes a health argument for climate action and calls on governments and policymakers to urgently tackle the emergency. The burning of fossil fuels is killing us, warns the World Health Organization report, noting that the practice is causing millions of premature deaths every year through air pollutants, costing the global economy billions of dollars annually and fueling the climate crisis. In the foreword, WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus highlights that human-caused global heating is impacting droughts, extreme heat, floods, hurricanes, and wildfires. He adds, climate change is the single biggest health threat facing humanity. And while no one is safe from the health impacts of climate emergency, they are disproportionately felt by the most vulnerable and disadvantaged. Adds, protecting people's health from climate change requires transformational action in every sector, including on energy, transport, nature, food systems, and finance. The public health benefits from implementing these ambitious climate actions far outweigh their cost. Tedros, in a statement, added, COVID-19 pandemic has shone a light on the intimate and delicate links between humans, animals, and the environment. The same unsustainable choices that are killing our planet are killing people. The same unsustainable choices that are killing our planet are killing people, the agency leader added, underscoring how important COP26, the upcoming UK-hosted summit that will be held in Glasgow, Scotland, is to meet the goals of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. WHO calls on all countries to commit a decisive action at COP26 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because in our own interest. WHO's new report highlights 10 priorities for safeguarding the health of people and the planet that sustain us. The priorities of the WHO explained at length in this report are commit to a health recovery. The health is not negotiable. Harness the health benefits of climate action. Build health resilience to climate risks. Create energy systems that protect and improve climate and health. Reimagine urban environments, transport and mobility. Protect and restore nature as the foundation of our health. Promote healthy, sustainable, and resilient food systems. Finance a healthier, fairer, and greener future to save lives. And listen to the health community and prescribe urgent climate action. The report comes a few weeks after the WHO updated its guidelines on air quality for the first time in over 15 years, warning that air pollution is now recognized as the single biggest environmental threat to human health. And the burden of disease attributable to it is estimated to be on a par with other major global health risks, such as unhealthy diet and tobacco smoking. Pointing to the new standards, which reflect the impact of fossil fuels on humans, Dr. Maria Neera, WHO's Director of Environment, Climate Change and Health, said recently that it has never been clearer that the climate crisis is one of the most urgent health emergencies we all face. Bringing down air pollution to WHO guideline levels, for example, would reduce the total number of global deaths from air pollution by 80%, while dramatically reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that fuel climate change, she said. A shift to more nutritious plant-based diets in line with WHO recommendations, as another example, could reduce global emissions significantly, ensure more resilient food systems, and avoid up to 5.1 million diet-related deaths a year by 2050. The new report was released alongside an open letter from 450 organizations representing over 45 million health workers, along with more than 3,400 individuals from 102 different countries. As health professionals and health workers, we recognize our ethical obligation to speak out about this rapidly growing crisis that could be far more catastrophic and enduring than the COVID-19 pandemic, the letter says of the climate emergency. We call on leaders of every country and their representatives at COP26 to avert the impending health catastrophe by limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the letter adds, and to make human health and equity central to all climate change mitigation and adaptation actions. The letter, which provides examples of how the climate emergency is already impacting human health and specific recommendations for moves that policymakers can pursue, concludes that these climate actions must be taken now to protect the planet, the earth, the health, well-being, and prosperity of all people alive today and for generations to come.